This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Somewhere north of north,
the far, far pole.
You are four times hotter, not so shiny. Cold but warm, the cold shoulder, no place for me.
How it started and how it's going at COP30 Climate Conference in Brazil. We join a live presentation by Johan Johansson, Icelandic Minister for the Environment, Energy and Climate.
Welcome, Johan.
Thank you. Dear Excellencies, colleagues, there's a fire. Oh, whoa.
That's right. It feels like 100 degree heat, 37.7, in the Brazilian jungle. The climate conference caught fire. American climate author and activist Bill McKibben said, "People warned each other and evacuated. Firefighters arrived and used their tools to put out the blaze." In other words, everyone behaved in precisely the opposite way they've reacted to the fire that's begun to consume the earth. You and I, we're going to the opposite pole, where the cold isn't so cold anymore. Biologist Trond Christensen explains a gigantic light experiment is taking place in the Arctic. Sea ice retreat makes new marine environments. Meanwhile, cold-loving microbes go through a revolution of their own as the Arctic warms up fast. This tiny world affects everything. Could a rapid change in microbial worlds unbalance things like oxygen or greenhouse gases, change the clouds, threaten our own existence? From Montreal, scientist Scott Sugden reviews current and projected effects of climate change in cryosphere microbial ecosystems. Then we go back to Brazil, where we started. Despite the fire and a deluge of fossil fuel lobbyists, three experts reveal the latest worrying science on thawing permafrost, the carbon bomb of the North. From the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative at COP30, you hear selected clips from Gustav Hegelius, Stockholm University, Christina Schadel from Woodwell Climate Research Center, and Fabian Seaman, Alfred Wegener Institute in Potsdam. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go to our first guest.
North of north, no south at all.
North of north,
at the pole, the far, far pole.
A gigantic light experiment is taking place in the Arctic, says a 2015 paper. Now we get an update with new science on the future of Arctic marine life, now that sea ice is in full retreat. Just published November 6th in Nature Communications, we are joined by lead author Trond Christensen. Trond's doctorate in biology comes from the University of Bergen. While publishing science, Trond advises on marine climate risk for Actia and the California nonprofit group Farallon Institute. From San Francisco, Trond Christensen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Alex, and thank you for having me.
We hear a lot about amplified warming in the Arctic. What makes it a light experiment?
Well, as many people know, the Arctic is a light, limited place, especially during the winter months. And with climate change, the seasonal sea ice cover that acts as a barrier for light to reach the ocean will decrease in extent and thickness. And when you have less ice, it means more light entering the water column, and that will have major consequences for the Arctic ecosystem.
In 2025, the Arctic sea ice maximum was the lowest ever recorded in the 47-year satellite record, but the rate of retreat has slowed. What do the latest coupled climate models predict for sea ice in the rest of this century?
The climate models agree that sea ice will continue to decrease in the future, and in some places ice will decrease faster than others. In our study, we find that the sea ice concentration in the Barents Sea will be drastically reduced by the end of the century, while in the Northern Bering and the Chukchi Sea, the loss is less dramatic. So that we're looking at both the Atlantic side of the Arctic and the Pacific side. However, for future predictions for sea ice extent varies depending on what future climate scenario you are considering. Different climate scenarios will project more or less sea ice depending on the projected overall warming associated with each scenario. So for our study, we consider two commonly used climate scenarios to see shared socioeconomic pathway framework. We looked at the SSP 245, which represents one possible future where global development follows current trends, and it's sort of considered a middle-of-the-road scenario. And then we also consider the SSP 585, which is the fossil fuel development scenario, where you can assume that the future economic growth is powered by fossil fuel use, high energy usage, and technological advancements. And based on the SSP 245 for the TRIPTC in the Pacific, we find that annual sea ice concentrations may be reduced by half, while in the Barents Sea and the Atlantic side, we find that less than 10% of ice cover remains by 2100.
So will that lead to significantly more sunlight reaching the Arctic Sea in certain periods of the year?
Yes, as it will. When the sea ice becomes thinner and the snow on top of ice melts, more light is able to penetrate the ice and enter the water column. And typically, thick, pure sea ice covered with snow would reflect 96% of incoming shortwave radiation, while the reflection from melting and thinning sea ice is drastically reduced, leading to more light being able to enter the ocean. In our study, we found that for large marine ecosystems, so the Chukchi Sea and the Barents Sea, light can increase by as much as 75 to 160% by 2100, depending on what climate scenario you're considering.
That could be a doubling of light. Those are big numbers. Now, as you say in your study, you're looking at the Barents Sea and the Chukchi over Alaska. Why focus there rather than a survey of the complete Arctic Ocean?
Well, that's actually a great question, and you're motivating me to start a new project looking at the Central Arctic. But for this study, we focus on the edges of the Arctic Ocean, as these are highly productive waters with seasonal sea ice cover, and would be the first focus of new fisheries exploitations and the climate change. We also wanted to highlight how climate change, although a global phenomenon, may impact geographic regions differently. And finally, both the Northern Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea and the Barents Sea that we focus on are important waters for commercial fisheries of walleye pollock in the Pacific and Atlantic cod in the Atlantic side. And at the same time, these are also very critical habitats for Arctic cod.
The role of sea ice and more light might be counterbalanced by more clouds over the Arctic in a changing climate. What did you find there?
Well, for both the Northern Bering and the Chukchi Sea and the Barents Sea, the average cloud cover remains nearly constant over time period 1979 to 2100, which is the period we looked at. And the value stays around 82 to 87%. So there's very small variations. We did find an increase of 2% increase for the SSP 585 scenario in the Northern Bering and the Chukchi Sea. And this could probably be related to increased areas of open water and increased evaporation. Still, there are differences and uncertainties in the projections in cloud cover across climate models, and it would be interesting to look deeper into the driving mechanisms of this.
So this is something that puzzled me ever since I encountered your paper. Why would increased sunlight and warmer summer waters in the Arctic Ocean lead to reduced phytoplankton levels? You would think more light would be good for plankton.
Well, we're not really saying that the overall levels of phytoplankton will be reduced. We're just saying that the timing of the phytoplankton spring blooms will change. For example, we find that shorter sea ice season and more open water can trigger spring blooms once the ocean temperature and light conditions are optimal. And for both the Northern Bering and the Chukchi Sea and the Barents Sea, we find increased biological production during April and May, and we find reductions in July and August. And for the Northern Bering and Chukchi Sea, we also find indications of an onset of fall bloom in October.
But I thought there was a theory that better conditions would lead to massive phytoplankton blooms, but then they would use up limited nutrients available in the Arctic Sea before they could be replenished.
That's a possibility, absolutely. The problem when you're looking at phytoplankton production using these climate models is that there's a huge uncertainty levels. The different climate models disagree with each other. One thing that they do sort of agree on is the changes in the timing of when events will take place. Whether that will actually lead to an increase or a decrease in phytoplankton production, the uncertainty levels there are quite high.
It's interesting you should say that, because I heard that from a Russian plankton scientist back in 2012. He said, we don't really know whether warming is going to be good or bad for them. So we're still in that spot. Your PhD involved polar cod, and in America those are called Arctic cod. Tell us about this strange fish, how they survive that harsh environment, and why does it matter how they do in these warming seas?
Polar cod is a very interesting species. It's a circumpolar species, meaning it's found continuously across both the Pacific and the Atlantic side of the Arctic Ocean. Small, light-colored codfish that is uniquely adapted to the cold Arctic conditions with antifreeze proteins that actually prevent their blood from freezing. This fish feed on zooplankton and shrimp and represents a keystone species, a critical component of the Arctic food web, and provides an excellent source of food for seals, whales, and seabirds. Interestingly, Arctic cod typically lay their eggs under or near sea ice, where they are protected from breaking waves and UVB radiation in the surface layer. And once the eggs hatch, the larva can actually feed on the ice algae underneath the ice. And the survival of eggs is closely linked to temperature. And as the water is warm in the Arctic, the survival rates of their eggs drastically decline. When the temperature reaches 5 degrees Celsius, there's no survival. So you could think of the egg stage as being sort of a bottleneck stage for the species' survival. But because polar cod are found in Arctic environments, either under or associated with sea ice, there is a lot we do not know about this species, as they are hard to find. And they're very infrequently observed. So, for example, for the Bering Sea, we typically only have observations during summertime, as the conditions are so rough during winter for making observations.
If polar cod use extra light to better hunt their prey, how do they live through long months of polar night?
Well, they likely reduce their metabolic demands during the darkest months when food is less abundant, though they remain active swimmers rather than entering through dormancy. Their antifreeze proteins allow them to remain active in sub-zero waters. They also build up lipid reserves during the productive spring and summer months that help sustain them through winter's leaner times. We observe polar cod spawn in vicinity to sea ice, but we also observe them in open water. So clearly these species can adapt and survive under different conditions, but we have limited amount of observations. I mean, we think that they would be more protected under sea ice with a higher chance of survival through the difficult early life stages.
Your team considers all kinds of factors determining whether solar energy reaches into the ocean or is reflected back towards space. And climate projections do show a more stormy future near the poles. How does that influence light in the sea and warming?
Arctic surface wind speeds are projected to increase substantially under climate change, with the most pronounced changes occurring during autumn and summer and winter. Stronger winds, increased waves, and the surface roughness of the ocean, and the tiny air bubbles that forms in waves, the white caps, they scatter and reflect more light compared to a flat surface. So we account for that in our modeling of light.
What I don't see in this paper is any link between heat and light. That is, more energy is moving into the sea because there is no sea ice. But how is that heating the ocean, yet increased light warms water? Can you sort out this confusion between heat and light for a non-scientist?
Well, the climate models do model incoming light into the ocean, and this is reflected in the modeled ocean temperature. As part of our study, we visualize how the shrinking sea ice concentration leading to more open water is accompanied by a strong increase in ocean temperature also. The change in ocean temperature is directly calculated from the flux of shortwave radiation into the ocean density, and the heat capacity of the ocean.
On land, we find brown bears from the boreal starting to arrive in the land of polar bears. Species move poleward with warming. What does your study find out about marine species moving north towards the Arctic?
Well, in our study, we discussed the potential for walleye pollock to expand northwards into the northern Bering and Turkish Sea. However, such movements may also be limited to seasonal migrations because of the persistence of the winter sea ice. However, for the Bering Sea, it is only the northern waters where Atlantic cod may be limited by seasonal sea ice. And this this northward movement is already happening, and surveys of pelagic fish, for example, in the Chukchi Sea between 2012 and 2019, found a drastic increase in walleye pollock abundance. They increased from 0.1% presence to 21% presence by 2019.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is biologist Trond Christensen. We are talking about the future of life in Arctic waters. In 2018, you co-authored a paper on the long cycle of cooling and warming in the North Atlantic called the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, or AMO. Where are we now in this 60 to 80 year long natural cycle, and could current Arctic warming be part of that?
Well, as far as I know, we are currently still in a warm phase of the AMO, and this phase is expected to last until around 2030. But we do know that the current warming of the Arctic far exceeds the amplitude of past AMO events, which underscores the role of human-driven warming of the Arctic. That said, the recent year's slowdown in the rate of sea ice loss could be linked to changes in the NAO and the AMO, where we go from negative phase in 2010 to a more positive phase now, which has led to reduced heat and moisture in the Arctic. There was also a very recent Nature Communications paper that dives into these details by Wang et al. 2025.
On Radio EcoShock, scientist Kevin Trenber suggested global warming may override even the strong cycle of El Nino and La Nina in the Pacific. Do you think climate change could alter or suppress the Atlantic multidecadal oscillation we just talked about?
That's a very difficult question to answer, and definitely on the edges of my research area. Perhaps climate change is more likely to fundamentally alter the AMO than to completely suppress it, primarily through changes to the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. However, there is also emerging scientific consensus that the traditionally called the AMO may itself be partly an artifact of external forcing rather than purely internal variability.
Your new paper hopes to improve prediction of future polar ecosystems. Is there a model specifically designed to forecast Arctic light changes and resulting marine warming? Should we have such a model?
Well, all of the global climate models, such as the CMIP-6 models, coming from the Coupled Model Intercomparison Project, which is used by the IPCC, include calculations and projections of Arctic light and temperature. In these models, the change in temperature of the Arctic Ocean is directly affected by advection of warm water from the south, the atmosphere ocean heat flux, and the difference in temperature of the air and the ocean, and also incoming shortwave radiation that heats up the water column. The radiative transfer model that we created in the study we're talking about now takes the output from these climate models and use these output as input to calculate the spectrally resolved light that comes through the atmosphere and finally enters the ocean. And our model accounts for changes in sea ice thickness, snow concentration and thickness, and many other variables that affect the reflection and the absorption of light. And the benefit of utilizing our radiative transfer model is that you can actively explore how different wavelengths of light, such as the visible or the UV component of light, will change under different climate scenarios across a range of different climate models. This allows you to really explore the uncertainty levels in light calculations across a modeling portfolio.
This paper in Nature Communications puts prediction graphs for the IPCC intermediate scenario, called SSP 2.5 to 4.5, right into the main paper. Results for the more alarming SSP 5 to 8.5 scenario are back in the supplementary materials. Some experts guessed, say, without a drastic change in human affairs, our current emissions is likely to reach higher warming. Tell us what your team found for the Arctic marine environment if that worst-case IPCC scenario arrives.
Yes, so we use the SSP 585 scenario to consider the worst-case scenario or possible consequences of climate change for the Arctic Ocean. And what we found was alarming. We found that temperatures in the Chukchi Sea could increase by as much as 6.9 degrees Celsius during August or in summertime, up from today's average of 1.4 degrees. For the Barents Sea, we found similar strong increase in temperature of 6.8 degrees Celsius during summertime, compared to today's average of 3.3 degrees. We also see rapid decrease in sea ice for both of these regions, with annual average values ranging between 0 and 20%, which is basically a complete collapse of the sea ice. Such dramatic changes would have enormous impact on the food web structure of Arctic ecosystems.
Your models on photosynthetically active radiation showed a possible tipping point for the Arctic Ocean around Alaska. Please explain.
Well, we did observe a sudden significant increase in photosynthetic active radiation or visible light after 2050 for the SSP 585 scenario in the northern Bering and Chukchi Sea. And this could indicate that the system reached a tipping point, potentially caused by a complete collapse of sea ice concentration and a strong increase in air and ocean temperatures.
There's a back and forth between better and worse conditions for fish during coming warming. Overall, when you add it up, Trond, are we looking at diminished or better commercial fisheries in polar seas due to warming?
I do think that some boreal fish species like Atlantic cod and walleye pollock will benefit from warming waters as the temperatures get closer to their preferred temperatures. This could have potential benefits for new areas opening up to these species, and that again could open up to increased commercial fisheries in new regions. But it could also mean that areas further south have become less habitable due to the temperatures have become too high.
In years of interviews with scientists, the talk was more about sunlight heating the sea. No one explored the impact of more light. It's like someone turned on a light switch up there, illuminating a hidden world. What do you think about this gigantic light experiment?
I think the climate projections on severely decreased sea ice concentration and rapid warming in the future will potentially eradicate the Arctic ecosystem as we currently know them, unless we start reducing fossil fuel usage and reducing the impact of climate change. I'm still optimistic that the world will come around to make a real effort in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but we need to do more than what we're currently doing to avoid having the projected gigantic light experiment actually come true.
I know you have several projects on the go, from fisheries adaptation programs to more regional marine climate forecasts. Would you like to pick one to tell us about?
Well, I really enjoy projects that have real-world applications for communities or actors that are grappling with how resources may need to be managed differently under climate change. In one case, I have worked with local community to understand which species may move out of their allocated fishing area and which may move in. In another project, I'm trying to identify which aquaculture areas may be better suited for future climate conditions. I like trying to find ways to do innovative science that can also be useful for better management and stewardship of our ocean resources.
From San Francisco, we've been speaking with biologist and fisheries specialist Dr. Trond Christensen. He is lead author of the new paper, Climate Change Impacts on Ocean Light in Arctic Ecosystems. That is open access, free for anyone to read. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Trond, thank you for sharing your time and this science with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
This is EcoShock Radio. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
It turns out life is everywhere. From glaciers to permafrost, strange species survive conditions even in the dark, well below freezing. Now microbial life in the ice world is changing Earth's climate as climate changes them. A team of scientists reviewed what is known. They just published the paper, Current and Projected Effects of Climate Change in Cryosphere Microbial Ecosystems. The lead author is Scott Sugden, a research scientist and lecturer at McGill University in Montreal. He joins us now. Scott Sugden, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there, Alex. Thank you so much for having me.
Was there a particular question that drove you and your colleagues to assess life in the coldest places?
You know, like you just mentioned, Earth has many cold temperature ecosystems, permafrost, glaciers, sea ice, and all of these ecosystems are really sensitive to warming. And so, you know, we kind of set out to ask this question, well, across all of these ecosystems, what are some of the general consistent truths that we see in terms of microbial responses to warming? And then where is there nuance? You know, where do we need to put an asterisk next to that truth and say, well, this is true most of the time, but in a few cases it might be a little different?
Well, these little creatures that we cannot see colonize some seemingly impossible environments. Tell us about surprising places in the catalog of cold, hardy life.
It's truly amazing where these microorganisms are able to live and metabolize, you know, inside glacial ice, frozen environment. You know, you'd think there's a lot of water there because it's ice, but you know, most of that water is frozen, so it's not available for a cell to use. Similarly, in permafrost, so soil that's, you know, deep underground and frozen all year long, microorganisms are able to find these really, really thin veins of water that provide just enough to survive. There are ecosystems in the Arctic, in some of the places that we work, some springs that discharge water from deep underground. This water is significantly saltier than seawater. -5 degrees Celsius most of the time, and still microorganisms are able to live there.
What are the lowest temperatures where living things have been found, and how do they survive down there?
So lowest temperature that they've been found is tricky because microorganisms can often live or survive at lower temperatures than they're active. They can just go into kind of periods of dormancy, the same way an animal might hibernate through the winter. If it just gets a little bit too cold, a microorganism will shut down and wait for the right time. But microbial activity has been detected as low as -20, -25 degrees Celsius, active microbial activity. And a lot of what they do is they find these really thin veins of water that contain higher concentrations of salt. So high salt concentrations in water lowers the freezing point. And so even at, you know, -7, -8 degrees, if the water is salty enough or contains enough solutes, you'll have this thin vein of water that's preserved that allows these cells to live.
Scott, are there viruses in this frozen world? And what about the stories of ancient organisms that could cause disease emerging from long frozen stores?
There are viruses in these ecosystems. These viruses serve more of an ecological role. They're kind of the predators of the bacteria that live in these ecosystems. So we're not talking about viruses that, you know, might infect humans or cause human health issues. These are kind of important aspects of any microbial community.
Why do you say, quote, the trajectory of our warming world will be closely linked to microbial activity within the warming cryosphere?
That's a wonderful question, and it's one that has and continues to fascinate me. You know, all of these microorganisms that live in these really cold temperature environments, for the longest time, they've been really strongly limited by kind of two major things. One, they don't have a lot of food that they can use for their metabolism, or in the cases where there might be a lot of food available, that food is frozen, so they can't actually use it. So limitation number one, not much food. And then number two, these cold temperatures have really slowed down their metabolisms. It's the same as, you know, humans, when we get hypothermic, our metabolisms will slow down. At low temperatures, these bacterial metabolisms slow down. And that's been the truth for the past, you know, several hundred years. But now, with climate change, both of those limitations are going away. As these ecosystems thaw, more food becomes available. And that's not just temperature driven, but more precipitation, more runoff will move nutrients around, make more food available. And then warming temperatures are accelerating these metabolisms. And so both of those things, when you think about them happening across a landscape as vast as the cryosphere, think of how much of the world is covered by permafrost, sea ice, glaciers, think Antarctica in there as well, the Greenland ice sheet. Even small upticks in microbial activity over such a large area are going to start to have some really profound consequences.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex returns with Dr. Scott Sigerton on the hidden microbial life in the ice world.
The Antarctic ice sheet alone covers about 8.3% of Earth's land surface. Were you able to find out much about the microbes living there, or is that still largely unknown?
Deep within Antarctica is still more largely unknown. There are some places in Antarctica that have attracted particular research attention. For example, there's a place in Antarctica called the Dry Valleys, which, as their name implies, are one of the driest environments on Earth. But I hesitate to generalize findings from a few places across the continent as big as Antarctica.
One thing we learned from talking with microbiologist David Thaler at the University of Basel, there is no catalog of all the microlife on Earth, and that can actually never be constructed because they evolve so quickly that new living things tend to show up in every sample, he told us. Does that sound like we only know a fraction of what is alive in the cryosphere?
I would agree. It's one of the challenges with cataloging microbial species in that way is, like this previous guest has mentioned, that there are so many species and they change so rapidly. But in terms of when we're thinking about their influences on the climate and other aspects of ecosystem function, even though microbial species and their identities might vary and change a lot among sites or even among years, a lot of their functions, a lot of what they're doing in an ecosystem are pretty conserved or consistent, which is how we can start to study how these communities are responding to warming.
Talk to us about life in the upper layer of glaciers and ice sheets, the so-called weathering crust.
So the weathering crust is the very surface layer of a glacier, a layer that receives, lots of sunlight input and provides a good habitat for photosynthetic microorganisms. You can think, on top of the glacier, there's a lot of sunlight coming in, especially in Arctic regions where you get 24-hour sunlight in the summer. That provides a good niche for photosynthetic microorganisms to survive.
Is there anything living deep inside the glaciers and the ice sheets?
That's a trickier question for us as scientists, because to study microbial life deep within a glacier, we need to be able to drill down and collect ice deep within the glacier. And that, continues to be a pretty strong logistical challenge. There's some limited evidence that microorganisms do survive in these deeper glacial environments, that they are still active there, but something that's still really tough for us to measure.
So about a quarter to a half of organic carbon stored on land on this planet is in the cryosphere, we're told, held there like a cold locker. What did your study find about the impacts of extra warming in the Arctic when it comes to microbes releasing this carbon to the atmosphere?
So like I mentioned earlier, for the longest time, this carbon has been locked away, frozen, not available for microorganisms to use. And even the little bits that were available, microbial metabolisms have been really slow because of the cold temperatures. With a little bit of warming, we start to see that a lot of these resources, these food resources, carbon stores, become available for microorganisms to use, and their metabolisms start to accelerate. And where this becomes challenging is, so accelerated metabolism, microorganisms eat these foods, this organic material that's been locked away in that carbon locker, and they respire it. So what that means is they send carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as a result of their metabolism. And more carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere, of course, not a good thing in the context of climate change. The other side to that story, though, is that photosynthetic metabolisms, metabolisms that take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, back into the soil or the ice, also accelerate. And a good thing for climate change. But what we see is that respiration, that process of sending carbon to the atmosphere, accelerates more quickly than photosynthesis, that process of bringing carbon back. And so as these ecosystems are starting to warm, they're starting to send more and more carbon into the atmosphere than they're taking out.
We picture a very rich trove of nutrients becoming available in thawing permafrost. Are there any signs of limits, like some missing nutrients or gases that could stall a wave of new microbial life near the warming poles?
So right now, a lot of these microorganisms are limited because they don't have enough nitrogen or phosphorus. That has been a significant kind of constraint on their activity. And in ecosystems that don't have much nitrogen or phosphorus, we see these warming effects are dampened a bit because the microorganisms still don't have enough for their metabolism. But when there's nitrogen and phosphorus around, microorganisms are pretty happy to start using it once they've warmed up.
There are kind of two parts to climate impacts we're talking here. I mean, changes happening now or expected in the next decade or two, and then there's the long-term play of new ecosystems developing. Has climate change already impacted microbe life in ways scientists can document now?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that we're seeing with warming environments is changes in a lot of these cryosphere habitats. You imagine, you know, what has been a glacier and a glacial microbial community, with warming, that glacier melts, it retreats, and we lose that glacial microbial ecosystem, and it becomes replaced with kind of a soil microbial ecosystem that takes over that space where the glacier was. And so those are things that lots of researchers are starting to study, this process of community change. What's challenging for us is that the understanding of microorganisms in these environments and the study of these microorganisms really only started about 15 to 20 years ago. And so unlike plant and animal ecology, where species have been documented and studied for quite some time, and you can look back at, you know, a 100-year historical record to see how things have changed, we don't have that long history of microbial understanding. So in many ways, we're seeing these changes as they're happening and don't necessarily have that baseline reference.
In another climate-related factor, you find that even the change of activity in microbes in the polar regions could change the albedo, the reflection of solar light back into space. How does that work?
Yeah, so you mentioned earlier the weathering crust, this layer on the top of a glacier. And I mentioned that there's a lot of photosynthetic microorganisms that live there. Photosynthetic microorganisms have a little pigment or a little bit of color to them. That's what helps them absorb the energy from the sunlight. And so if we start to get more and more of these photosynthetic microbes, you can think of this kind of big algae bloom on a glacial surface that reduces or that pigments the glacial surface a little bit. So instead of this, you know, nice white snow or ice, you get slightly pigmented, slightly purplish or pinkish or greenish coloration. And that color absorbs more solar energy and causes the ice and snow to melt faster.
Is it fair to say that the warm-up of cold living spaces creates multiple climate feedbacks and some slow warming, but generally it's going to lead to more warming?
That's the conclusion that we're reaching right now, is that in general, this warming of the cryosphere is going to increase microbial activity in ways that promote further warming. And there's a lot of nuance to that. You know, like we've talked about, well, how much nitrogen and phosphorus there is. These nitrogen and phosphorus-rich ecosystems are probably going to contribute more. More limited ecosystems will contribute less. We also see variation based on how much oxygen is available. So some habitats, when they thaw, they go underwater, they become really wet. And so there's not a lot of oxygen available for use. Or some regions dry out, and so that increases the amount of oxygen that organisms can use. And those things can influence kind of the rate and magnitude of climate effects that these ecosystems have.
I'm curious, how was this review done? Did you survey a bunch of articles or use machine learning? What did you do to produce this?
I have not yet gotten on the machine learning bandwagon. So this was a lot of just a literature survey. Again, with this question, we wanted to identify general truths across the breadth of cryosphere ecosystems. So we wanted to make sure we were seeing what people were discovering in sea ice, in permafrost, in glaciers, in snow, in tundra soils, to really distill, well, you know, here are the things that we know that are consistent, and here are the things that are more context dependent.
As your review points out, a lot of papers are based on results from a few field trips to select locations, and most of those studies are in summer just for logistical and human survival reasons. If I were a multi-billionaire and I authorize $1 billion for research on climate changes to life in the cryosphere, Scott, what kinds of research would you recommend to fill in the gaps in our knowledge?
Now that is a challenging question. There is a lot of things that we don't know. And like you highlighted, so far, nations and governmental organizations have done a really great job of funding and supporting cryosphere research that brings us to the same places every time. I think if I could take that $1 billion, what I would want to do is I'd want to get a really geographically distributed set of samples. You know, I'd want ice from all the major areas that are covered by ice. I'd want permafrost from all the major areas that have permafrost so that we can get an understanding of what some of these baseline qualities are. You know, how much, we don't always know how much nitrogen or phosphorus is in some different ecosystems just because we haven't been there to measure it. We don't always know what the permafrost temperature is in some different ecosystems just because we haven't always been there to measure it. So we know how microorganisms respond to temperature generally and to moisture generally and to nutrients generally. And so if we can get better resolution on, well, you know, what is the moisture and nutrient content across the cryosphere, that would be really helpful.
So after all of this work, Scott, what is your greatest concern? Is this just a story of life morphing into new ecosystems, or could a rapid change in microbial worlds change things for us as humans?
I think it's important to recognize that these changes in cryosphere microbial ecosystems, although we talk about them mostly with respect to their effects on the climate, which certainly affects us, these consequences can also have all sorts of other cascading effects on human ecosystems. You know, increasing microbial metabolisms can produce contaminants, and then precipitation and runoff will wash those contaminants into the ocean, where they end up in the food supply. And so it can affect food and income security for indigenous people and people who rely on marine resources. Similarly, you brought up albedo reduction. We're seeing these changes affect the melt and timing of ice. And so although we talk about climate, I think it's important to recognize that these changes affect more than just the climate. They're affecting all sorts of things that we as humans are going to start experiencing if we haven't already.
I think that's a great point, but I would like to say, too, that what we haven't talked about here is methane production, and that's a big concern for many of our listeners, that permafrost thaw or other changes in the Arctic will release a lot of methane. What do you think?
Yeah, so earlier I mentioned how the availability of oxygen in an ecosystem can really influence the outcomes of these accelerated microbial processes. Permafrost, when it thaws, in many cases can become anaerobic. There's not a lot of oxygen for microorganisms to use. And when microorganisms lack oxygen, one of the things that they'll do with their food or their carbon supply is produce methane. But on the other hand, if we have ecosystems that dry out more, that become more aerobic, lots of those microorganisms will eat methane and they'll release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere instead. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And so back to your question of, you know, what would I do with $1 billion? The reason we're concerned about permafrost and methane is because a lot of these habitats become anaerobic and therefore become methane sources. But there are a lot of these permafrost habitats that we just don't know whether they're skewing towards an anaerobic or an aerobic lifestyle. And so it's hard to really understand and quantify, well, how much methane is going to come out of there.
What are you working on now?
So my lab's research, I personally have been doing a lot of work looking at the transition from glacial ice communities to post-glacial soil communities. That transition I mentioned earlier, you know, as glaciers recede, we're seeing a huge community change, and that has cascading influences on microbial function. Our lab has also done some work with permafrost. There's a site that we've been to over many years, and so we're looking at kind of changes in microbial metabolisms over about 15 years of permafrost thaw.
From McGill University, we've been speaking with researcher Scott Sugden. He led a review study titled Current and Projected Effects of Climate Change in Cryosphere Microbial Ecosystems. It is a window to some of these far-out worlds, and you can find a link and notes about this paper in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Scott, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Well, thank you for having me, Alex. That sounds great. And once again, I want to emphasize, I really appreciate what you do to help bring research to the general public. I think this is, you know, really important messages that sometimes get lost in our little echo world of publications.
Radio EcoShock.
About a quarter of all land in the Northern Hemisphere has been frozen for thousands of years. Now it is thawing. New science finds more greenhouse gases and climate twists, none considered by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or by your government. I've selected key clips from three speakers at a COP30 presentation called Permafrost Thaw is Warming the Global Climate and Impacts Communities, Health, and Oceans. The first speaker is Gustav Hegelius, professor of physical geography at Stockholm University.
So my name is Gustav Hegelius. I'm a professor of physical geography at Stockholm University and also vice director of the Bolin Center for Climate Research at Stockholm. So I'm going to start us off today by giving first a brief introduction to what permafrost is, and then talk about some recent papers that are showing us that permafrost thaw is actually already warming the global climate and that the shift from a long-term sink of carbon into a net source of warming has already occurred. So this is the places where permafrost is completely gone. But this other map that I'm showing you now actually shows a different side of the same, sort of a different side of the same coin. This map shows you not where permafrost is gone, but actually the rate of warming. So instead, we're seeing the subsurface temperature change at 2 meters depth from 1997 to 2019. And here you see this very intensely red area is actually not in the south, but in northern Siberia. So in the really cold northern parts of Russia, this is where permafrost is warming the most. So permafrost is not just disappearing along the edges. The whole zone is being affected, and this affects the carbon cycle, people living there, ecosystems, and all of the other components. And the main driver behind this sort of rapid warming in the north is probably the loss of sea ice. It's really increasing the regional warming in this area a lot. So there are these couplings between different cryosphere elements. But the reason we're so concerned about permafrost thaw and the carbon cycle is the massive size of the permafrost carbon pool. So we have the atmosphere at almost 900 gigatons in the blue circle, all global vegetation about 500 gigatons, and then you have the big brown circle in the middle is all global soils, which is the largest carbon pool that turns over on these shorter timescales, which is a little bit more than 3,000 gigatons. But you see in orange, in the sort of middle here, is actually the global permafrost region, roughly 1,500 or 1,600 gigatons of carbon stored in this region. Even though it's not a massive part of the Earth system, it has such high carbon density that it stores this really large part of carbon. And recent papers have also pointed to the subsea permafrost system, so frozen seafloor underneath shallow Arctic oceans storing massive amounts of carbon as well, adding up almost 3,000 extra petagrams of carbon in the subsea system. Now, this is not responding perhaps as rapidly yet as the terrestrial system. It's thawing rapidly, but we're not yet seeing very large carbon fluxes, but they might come in the future. Now I'm going to switch over to talk a little bit about recent results which have shown that the permafrost region is not just projected to thaw in the future, the thaw is already now actually really affecting and even shifting the greenhouse gas balance from this region. So there was a big project called RECAP2, which put together permafrost region greenhouse gas budgets for CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide. And taken together, if you combine all of these greenhouse gases, we see that the region is already a net source of warming, so already warming the global climate. And this is contrary to what climate models typically show. The climate models don't have all of these processes, so in the models, the region still comes out as being a net sink because of growing carbon uptake in forest, but the new estimates show that this is no longer the case. And I also mentioned that our earlier budget only went as far as to 2020. And since 2020, we've actually seen an even stronger intensification of the fire regime and the fire cycle in the Arctic, even so further strengthening this source of warming. This is a Twitter feed from the Weather Channel from 2023. In this year, there was a record fire year in Canada. And wildfires in Canada alone emitted on the scale of the whole EU that year. So those are the direct emissions. And after this, permafrost will keep thawing in these areas and it will keep being a source for a long time into the future. And so you see in this image already fires occurring all across Canada. And what's really crucial here is that the date is June 6th. So this is super early. This is, boreal forest is not supposed to burn in the beginning of June. Boreal forests do burn naturally, but not this early. And this was, if you have really early snow melt and record heat waves triggering fires this early in the season, is really an anomaly and really an outlier. But I think the important thing is that if you compare the permafrost emissions, they are really on on the scale of extrapolated emissions from major emitters. So looking into the future, permafrost will emit on the scale of a large country, perhaps more than the EU if we stay on path we are now, and if we go on even, you know, up towards 3 degrees or warmer, it's on the scale of US or China emissions by the end of the century. So this is really dire news. Summarizing, the permafrost region is already a net source of greenhouse gases and affects near-term mitigation needs. So it's already affecting us. On mid to long term, 2050 and onwards, we will see committed and profound permafrost thaw impacts, decreasing emission budgets, and really damaging infrastructure as well. And overshoot warming, which we are unfortunately basically committed to now, would trigger irreversible permafrost thaws that drives additional warming for centuries even after the climate stabilizes.
That was Dr. Gustav Hegelius, Stockholm University. Next up from the Cryosphere Pavilion at COP30 in Brazil is Dr. Christina Schadl from the Woodwell Climate Research Center.
So I want to focus on two different types of thawing, just to make sure we're all on the same page. Generally, across the landscape overall, we have gradual thaw, which is the deepening of the active layer, where the top part of the soil thaws during the summer and then freezes back up in the winter. This is the most common form of thaw, which is happening across the entire Arctic. And each summer, that thaw just goes deeper and deeper. And then, as Gustav already said, there is about 1.5 trillion tons of carbon in the permafrost region. And then the other form of thaw that is really important and has gotten much more attention is what we call abrupt thaw. And you see on the picture to the left, you see an ice wedge, and most permafrost contains ice, but in some areas there are these massive ice wedges, and there's a person in front of the ice wedge just for comparison of the size, how big those ice wedges are. And now you can imagine if it gets really warm and the ice melts, then that huge space that has been taken up by the ice will, like, the ice goes away, and then the ground collapses, and then you end up with a landscape that looks like the one here to the right, where it's all just collapsed. And so this has impacts, huge impacts for infrastructure that's built on permafrost, but then it also has impact, obviously, on, like, vegetation and ecosystems, and there are very deep soil layers that are suddenly exposed to much, much warmer temperatures than they otherwise would, because they would be really deep down. And that increases carbon emissions by quite a lot as well. And only about 20% of the landscape are affected by abrupt thaw, but that doesn't mean it's not important. And that's a thing that has been relatively newly identified. And then Gustav just mentioned that nicely before me. There is other impacts on permafrost thaw through wildfire. It burns a lot of the above ground vegetation, and with that, of course, a lot of carbon as well. But then the other impact that's really important to be aware of is the fire burns the organic layer, and the organic layer insulates the permafrost. And if that layer is gone, then you have really warm temperatures penetrating into the ground, and then you end up with these ice wedges melting faster, you're ending up with collapsing ground and much more destabilization. So there are these disturbance effects that are really important, but are not well enough quantified, and especially not quantified in future modeling projections. And that's where I want to go next. We have abrupt thaw and these wildfire interactions with the ground. They are not included in any of the current Earth system models that are being used for IPCC assessments. And that means we are missing a huge part of the carbon emissions from that Arctic region. So what we are doing is we are using a reduced complexity Earth system model called OSCAR, which emulates what other Earth system models are doing and uses those projections. We are using that reduced Earth system model, and here I'm showing you the cumulative emissions in gigaton CO2 equivalent, which includes CO2 and methane, for the time frame 2025 to 2100, so for the next 75 years. And to the left, you're seeing a high mitigation scenario, so that would be SSP 1.2.6, and then to the right, a low mitigation scenario and more like current policies. And under high mitigation, we're projecting about 108 gigatons of CO2 equivalent, and under a low mitigation scenario, twice as much. But then the picture changes dramatically if we're adding these disturbance processes. And now you can see with the three additional bars, this is a stacked bar where each color represents the emissions from one of those components that are listed in the legend. So red shows the additional emissions from abrupt thaw, then combustion shows the additional emissions from combustion, obviously, and then you also have in the blue bar the emissions from post-fire thaw. And so with each of the mitigation scenarios, there are emissions to be expected from all of those different processes. And if you're including abrupt combustion and post-fire thaw on top of gradual thaw, you're adding 166 to 258% carbon, so more than twice as much carbon if you're accounting for all these disturbance processes. But these emissions are not included in IPCC. IPCC does recognize that additional ecosystem responses to warming from like CO2 and methane fluxes would further increase concentrations of these gases in the atmosphere, and that there is very high confidence. But those numbers are not included. There's high confidence it will happen, but they're not in there. And that causes a big problem for negotiations here, for example, or in general, when you're talking about how much carbon do we have left. This graph shows you the avoidance budget reduction, which is a complicated term, but it means if you're adding gradual thaw, abrupt thaw, and the other disturbance processes, you're reducing the available carbon budget to avoid temperature goals. And this is obviously much higher in order to avoid the 2-degree temperature target. And we've calculated that it reduces about 5 years that we have left. And that's a significant number, given that we are already relatively close to these targets.
You just heard clips from a presentation at COP30 by Dr. Christina Schadl. Our final speaker is young scientist Fabian Seemann from the Alfred Wegener Institute in Potsdam, Germany.
Yeah, as said, my name is Fabian Seemann, and I'm a PhD candidate at the Alfred Wegener Institute in Potsdam, Germany. And so far in the session, we have mostly talked about terrestrial permafrost, but I would like to shift the focus more now on subsea environments as well as coastal environments, as there have been key updates on this land-to-ocean continuum, but also specifically on subsea permafrost environments and coastal regions around the Arctic. Subsea permafrost has originally formed as terrestrial permafrost during glacial times when sea levels were lower compared to today, when ice was bound or water was bound in the ice caps. Now with sea level rise after the glacials, sea levels rose and these coastal regions became inundated and flooded by the Arctic Ocean, resulting in subsea permafrost today. And the area that is covered by subsea permafrost actually equals the area of the country size of Algeria, which is the 10th biggest country in the world, just to stress the aerial extent of subsea permafrost. Now, subsea permafrost is also warming and thawing with climate change, and this is mainly regulated by sea ice. As sea ice extend is shrinking, ocean's temperatures are increasing, and thereby also warming and thawing subsea permafrost. Generally, the subsea carbon pool is of low reactivity, but still we have current emissions from subsea permafrost by about 50 teragrams of carbon per year. But there's not only subsea permafrost, it even extends further below. And I'm going to talk about methane hydrates, which is essentially frozen methane, which is stable under low temperature and high pressure. So on the left panel, you see a plot showing the shelf area as found, for example, in Siberian coastal waters, where you have below the water column the subsea permafrost environment. And below this permafrost domain, in parts, we have methane hydrates sitting. And permafrost sort of acts as a lid in these environments. But as permafrost starts to thaw out, this lid function of the permafrost weakens, potentially opening up spaces for methane hydrates to escape through the sediments into the water column and eventually to the atmosphere.
That was Fabian Seemann from the Alfred Wegener Institute in Potsdam, Germany, speaking at COP30 on permafrost thaw in a warming world, November 14th, 2025. For a summary of the main points in these presentations and links to all the science discussed in this show, you just need to head over to my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. That's ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.